Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, gamers score big for science and AIDS research. Planets in the night sky after the equinox. And a fish story that's 350 million years old. Here's a scientist soundbite.
What the motivation with the Folded Project was actually be able to combine what humans are good at and what computers are good at to be able to solve these new kinds of difficult problems that neither one of them could solve alone.
That was computer scientist Seth Cooper. More with him later. But first, Emily Howard joins us for Science News of the Week. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me, Jorge. Researchers have discovered that bats prefer to rest with their closest pals, rather than with bats they don't know very well. They found that although bats change where they sleep every few days, they nearly always roost with the same bunch of bats, forming tight-knit social groups. Tom August conducted this research at the University of Exeter in the UK. He said bats build long-term companionships with other individuals, and these companions are members of exclusive social groups that can last for many years.
On September 18th, scientists reported in the journal Nature, Structural and Molecular Biology, a successful collaboration with players of the video game Foldit. They enlisted the gamers' help to understand the structure of a protein that plays a key role in the development of a virus similar to HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, in monkeys. Scientists had been stumped about the structure of this AIDS-linked protein for decades, but Foldit players, who earned points by efficiently folding and flipping 3D models of proteins, figured out the correct shape of the protein in just a few days. Researchers say this breakthrough might ultimately help them find targets for new drugs for HIV/AIDS.
On September 21st, Typhoon Roke made landfall in central Japan, southwest of Tokyo. Thousands of commuters were stranded overnight as the storm suspended rush hour train service in Tokyo for several hours. With winds around 100 miles an hour, the typhoon made its way up Japan's northeast coast. It dumped up to 17 inches of rain in some areas, triggering landslides and floods that left at least 16 people dead or missing. Typhoon Roke did spare the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, which was severely damaged during the major earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan in March of 2011.
A report released September 21st shows that global emissions of carbon dioxide, or CO2, a major greenhouse gas and contributor to global warming, increased by 45% between 1990 and 2010. Emissions reached an all-time high of 33 billion tons in 2010. The report comes from the European Commission's Joint Research Center and PBL Netherlands, Environmental Assessment Agency. It suggests that continued growth in the developing world, especially China and emerging economies, and economic recovery by the industrialized countries are the main reasons for the increase.
An astronomer with the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder thinks our solar system might once have had five gas giant planets, instead of the four we know today. Those four are Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. After running a series of 6,000 simulations on our solar system's birth and early formation, astronomer David Nesverny believes that a Neptune-sized planet was ejected from our solar system after an encounter with Jupiter some 3.9 billion years ago. In his simulations, he said, a solar system starting with five giant planets was 10 times more likely to lead to today's configuration of planets than a solar system with four giant planets.
Science interviews up next. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. video game players have scored a collective win for science on a problem that stumped scientists for over a decade. Players of the free puzzle video game Foldit have solved the complex structure of a protein linked to AIDS in monkeys. This discovery provides insights into the design of antiretroviral drugs for humans, according to an international science team that reported the findings in the journal Nature. On the line now is study co-author Seth Cooper, a computer scientist and creative director of the Center for Game Science at the University of Washington. Dr. Cooper, welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me.
What are the main findings of the research you published in the journal Science on a protein structure solved by video gamers?
The main findings were that through the video game Foldit, the game players were actually able to come up with the solution of a protein that scientists had been studying for over a decade, but had still not yet been able to come up with the structure for. And so basically we had sort of tried to pick up where the previous scientific methods, both experimental and computational, had so far failed to produce the correct structure of this protein that the scientists were interested in. And we were able to give it to the game players, and they were able to come up with the correct structure of the protein by playing the game Foldit. And the particular structure that they're interested in was relevant to AIDS. It was a protein that sort of related to the proliferation and maturation of the AIDS virus. So actually, being able to know the structure can help scientists understand how the protein works and potentially come up with ways to sort of prevent it from working.
Now tell us a little bit about this game. It's called Foldit. What is Foldit, and how do scientists work together with gamers on protein puzzles?
So Foldit is an online multiplayer game where the players are competing and collaborating to try to produce accurate models of protein structures. And so Foldit is primarily organized as a leaderboard competition where we can post protein structures online, and then the players will try to compete to get the highest score by folding the protein. And they compete against all the other players who are trying to fold the same protein.
Yeah, I thought that was cool how in the Nature article, the three players, S.P. Vincent, Grabhorn, and Mimi, they were actually credited in the Science article.
Yeah, their group, the Folded Contenders group, is actually an author on the paper. So this is definitely the first case that I know of where sort of a video game a team has sort of been an author on this kind of major scientific publication.
And would you mind kind of summing up why this worked where past methods had failed? I mean, it looks, I believe in the science paper that there are over 70,000 different attempts at this. And maybe through all that volume, I guess, that's how a solution can eventually get brought to light.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of it, or what the motivation with the Foldit project was actually be able to combine what humans are good at and what computers are good at to be able to solve these new kinds of difficult problems that neither one of them could solve alone. The computational moves are often, you know, very random and not very guided. So they try to, you know, a whole bunch of different protein structures out and see which ones score the best. But they're actually so many potential shapes that an individual protein can take that it's very hard for the computer to actually find the right answer through this kind of random search. And so what we hope to do with Foldit, and what I think we've been able to show with these recent results, is that the players who have, you know, spatial reasoning and problem solving and kind of more deeper critical thinking skills are able to reason about how the pieces of the protein should fit together. And so they have a more guided search than the computer would. And so in this way, we can sort of leverage the human problem-solving abilities and spatial reasoning abilities and augment that with the computational ability to optimize the structures and things like that and compute the score and the energy of the protein and together try to solve these difficult problems in science.
for people listening right now, is this game like some other game people are familiar with, Tetris maybe, or what is it like?
Yeah, I mean, we've often compared it to maybe a 3D kind of Tetris because it's a lot about fitting the pieces of the protein together. There's a few fundamental rules of protein folding that are introduced in the game through a series of introductory levels, and one of them is kind of like trying to pack the protein in well, like Tetris pieces. So that's kind of maybe an analogy for how the game works, but it's actually pretty different from Tetris when you get to playing it.
That was computer game researcher Seth Cooper. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about what's happening in the global night sky, planets to see after the equinox on late September and early October. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. Well, first of all, planets. There are five bright planets: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And let's just rule out Saturn right now. It's going to be in conjunction with the Sun, in other words, behind the Sun from Earth on October 13th. So Saturn is not visible now. So we're talking about four planets left that you can see around now.
Wow, four planets to see. So tell us more about where to see them and what we'll see.
So I want to talk about both hemispheres because we're past the equinox now, and that means something very special to stargazers. It means that the angle of the ecliptic, which is the path of the planets across the night sky, that angle of the ecliptic is very slanted with respect to our horizon in the evening. So the planets Mercury and Venus are actually in the evening sky now, but because that path of the planets is so low in the sky in the evening, they're kind of difficult to see from the northern hemisphere. If you were in the southern hemisphere right now, you could see both Mercury and Venus in the evening. From the northern hemisphere, you have a shot at Venus because Venus is so, so bright in the west after sunset, but very, very low in the sky. You might even need your binoculars. Take them out and scan along the southwestern horizon after sunset, and you might get a glimpse of the planet Venus.
So what about the other planets?
Well, in the early morning sky now, the planet Mars is high in the east at dawn. It's about equally visible from both hemispheres, and it's going to be really cool because Mars is a very bright, not very bright, but it's getting brighter. It's a bright reddish object, doesn't twinkle like the stars do. So you may notice it for that reason. On October 1st, Mars is going to be passing in front of the Beehive star cluster, which, again, is a binocular object. So if you have a pair of binoculars and you notice that bright reddish object in the pre-dawn sky, you know, you might turn your binoculars toward it and you might see Mars in front of the Beehive star cluster. It'll be a very beautiful sight around October 1st.
Is there one particular planet to look out for coming up in these months of late September, early October?
I've absolutely saved the best for last, and that is the planet Jupiter. Jupiter is the giant planet of our solar system, and most of the time it's not as bright as Venus. It's actually the second brightest planet after Venus. But as I said, Venus is kind of low in the evening sky now and not as easy to see. Jupiter, on the other hand, is coming into the very best place to see it for this year. So what happens is that Earth goes between the Sun and Jupiter about once a year, and that's going to happen this year on October 29th. So around now, starting around now, you're going to want to look for Jupiter in the evening sky. In early October, it's going to be rising after the sun sets. So wait till it gets good and dark outside. Look toward the eastern horizon, and lo and behold, you'll see this really bright object come over the eastern horizon, and that'll be the planet Jupiter.
Yeah, Jupiter's a great target for people with telescopes out there.
It's a great target for binoculars, too. You can turn I'll never forget the first time I turned a pair of binoculars on Jupiter and was able to see its several of its four largest moons, the Galilean satellites.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. Find us as Earth Sky. There was a time on Earth, about 400 million years ago, when scientists believed fish, with fleshy, lobed fins, started to evolve legs and eventually into creatures that walked. In September of 2011, scientists announced they had found a new species of fish that fit that bill from fossils 375 million years old. It was one big fish that didn't get away from the researchers. They describe it as 5 or 6 feet long, with a wide head, small eyes, and strong jaws lined with large, piercing teeth. On the line to explain the findings is Jason Downs, a paleontologist with the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. Dr. Downs, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what are the main findings of the study you've co-authored that has found evidence of a 375-million-year-old fish in Arctic Canada?
That's right. So this new species named Laconathus embryi is a Poralipiform, and that name probably doesn't mean too much to a whole lot of people. It's an entirely extinct group of what we call lobe-finned fishes. These are the aquatic vertebrates that have fins, but these fins are muscular and have internal skeletons and really serve as the precursors to the limbs that we see in more terrestrial tetrapods, those vertebrates that have four limbs and walk on land. In this phylogenetic position, in this position in the tree of life, it's certainly highlighting the transition between fins and limbs in so much as it is an aquatic lobe-finned fish. You know, this is very early in that transition between fins and limbs. I think the sort of exciting thing about this new species is that it's stretching the geographic range of this group, Laconathus, from Europe to North America for the first time. This is the first North American occurrence of Laconathus. And beyond that, our material is very complete, is very well preserved, and along with that, what we have now is a good reference species for Laconathus that includes aspects of the anatomy that previously were unknown, parts of the brain case, for instance, we're seeing in Laconathus embryi and had not seen before in Laconathus. So I think the contribution here is that we have very good material. We have a lot of material that represents a number of individuals, probably 20 or more individuals. And so we have a great sort of reference species for Laconathus and for Poralipiforms. It's great material.
I was hoping you might tell us a little bit about this creature, this Laconathus embryi. 375 million years old, these fossils. It's described as being about as big as a human, as an adult human,
right.
A little scary, maybe, if you encountered
sure.
it scuba diving or something. But tell us a little bit about this. What do scientists know what this fish was like?
as you say, this is an animal we believe to be about 2 meters long or 6 feet long, and we sort of have the suggestion that these are flat-bottomed, wide-bodied organisms, and they certainly have a very wide head. The head is twice as wide as it is long, and so it's got this very wide mouth, very robust jaws, long pointed teeth that we expect in a predatory organism. And so these body dimensions in combination with the nature of the jaws, the nature of the teeth, the position of the eyes, all of these things together are suggesting an animal that likely lived at the bottom of the water column and sort of employed a sit-and-wait type strategy of predation where its eyes are positioned so that it can keep an eye on what's happening above it, swimming overhead, and then sort of jumping out and being able to grab some prey item as it swims overhead. And like I say, and I just want to clarify that these types of stories that we tell are always one step beyond the data. And the data informs only so much, and any sort of discussion of how it was living its life is always something, because we can't observe it, we're really relying on inference here and some bit of speculation.
Dr. Downs, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.